Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
For the past 14 days and nights, like everybody else in Ireland, I've been glued to the television watching the stunning performances of the Irish Olympic athletes. And in doing so, my mind goes back to the Moscow Olympics in the summer of 1980. I was indeed fortunate to have been selected as a member of the RTE commentary team, led by Tim O'Connor, head of television, and Ian Corr, head of radio, both titans of sports broadcasting in Ireland. The hotel we stayed in was one of many built specifically for the Games. The staff spoke English, and the chatty manager adopted us as his happy Irish team. Each member of the commentary team was provided with an English-speaking university student. They would accompany us to the stadium, help us with translations, and act as our PA. The main mode of transport was the magnificent Metro, one of the world's busiest subways and famous for its extravagant interior. Opened in 1935 under Stalin, it was remarkable in its beauty. The stained glass windows, marble columns, crystal chandeliers, and much more. And what a lovely way to travel to work each day. The opening ceremony was a masterpiece of Russian exactness. Held at the grand arena of the Central Lenin Stadium, 80 countries participated and over 5,000 athletes competed, combined with breathtaking displays from Russian dancers and gymnasts, both beautiful and astonishing to watch. Amongst the VIPs visible was the formidable Russian President Leonard Brezhnev, and beside him the International Olympic Committee Chairman Lord Kilallen. This was the first Games to be held behind the Iron Curtain, and Brezhnev beamed with pride as Kilallen delivered the opening ceremony speech. My assistant Vitaly and I quickly became friends, and over time we knew one another and what we were thinking. One day, over coffee, between track races at the velodrome, knowing that he was studying American literature, I asked him what he thought of John Steinbeck. There was silence, and he looked away. "How about Hemingway?" I asked. He looked at me and quietly said, "Neither of those writers are permitted." After a deafening silence, he asked me, by any chance, would I have a copy of Time magazine in the hotel? I did, and the following morning I brought it along. He gestured for me to remove it from my briefcase and then carefully slide it up the side of the counter and slip it under his copy of Pravda. I felt like John le Carré, but I also felt uneasy, and I was glad to exit the velodrome that morning. Sadly, on the evening before the men's 100-metre breaststroke, our swimming commentator, Jim Sherwin, received word from Dublin of a family bereavement. That was most upsetting for all of us on the RTE team, as our comrade had to return home immediately. It also posed a problem. Tim O'Connor summoned me. "What do you know about swimming, John?" "Nothing," I replied. I had commentated on cycling, track and road, hockey and volleyball, but never, ever swimming. "And I can't swim either," I told Tim. "Don't worry," said Tim. "Just be at the pool first thing in the morning, and good luck. And remember, this is the gold medal event." The following morning, I found myself poolside. 7 world-class swimmers, all in pursuit of gold. And Duncan Goodhue, the British hope, was the only one I knew, because he was bald. Then, to my horror, they started donning swimming caps. So now I had 7 Duncan Goodhues. However, luck was on my side. I realised that the British hero, because he had shaved down, was the only one who wouldn't have to wear a cap. So I could at least focus on him and perhaps wing my way through this race. The noise was deafening. The 7 were now standing, poised and ready. "They're off," I cried as they hit the water. Then I realised they had jumped into the water feet first. Off about the business of loosening up, I corrected myself croakily. At this stage, I was tightening up. The pressure intensified. Now they were back on the starting line, waiting for the gun. They hit the water as though propelled, and seconds later it was clear to see the shining head was first on the turn by 2 seconds, and then he powered his way to victory, 1 second ahead of the Russian Mishkayov. Two lengths, 63 seconds, and gold for Goodhue. How I called it correctly, I do not know. Team RTE were hoarse, and they were willing him on as well, and that, I think, perhaps saved my face. One Sunday morning in Moscow, as I had no commentary commitments, I decided to go for a stroll in search of a church, of which there were very many, all of which were stunning works of art, some dating back to the 15th century. During Mass, I joined the long line of those queuing to receive Holy Communion. As I reached the altar with my head bowed and my cupped hands held out, with no warning, the minister of the Eucharist shouted and pointed at me, her eyes ablaze. Niet, niet, niet. Confused and shaken, I turned and walked back down the aisle. All eyes were on me. What on earth had I done wrong? Later that day, I related my experience to my now good friend, the hotel manager. He explained that my pale blue denim attire portrayed to some all that was evil in the West. And speaking of denim, there was another encounter. Virtually every morning as I left the hotel heading to work, standing close by waiting was a young man who, upon seeing me, would point at my denim jacket with hand gestures, suggesting he'd like to buy it from me. He was polite, but each morning I politely declined the offer. The morning of our departure from Moscow, he was there, a smile on his face as always. I handed him a parcel. No words were exchanged. There was an understanding between us. He hugged me, and he vanished. One of the highlights of Moscow 80 was when our hotel manager, our comrade, the loquacious Petru, invited three of us to dinner with his wife in their apartment on the outskirts of the city. The evening was a wonderful experience. We sat on the floor and dined on pelmeni, Russian dumplings, freshly baked bread, straight from the oven, full-bodied red wine and Jameson's. We had been advised when leaving Dublin to bring razor blades, soap, perfume and whisky, all gratefully received by our hosts. We laughed, discussing the rights and wrongs of the world's politics, and it was a meeting that I will never, ever forget. 2 days before our departure, an envelope was slipped under my bedroom door. 3 tickets to Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake at the Bolshoi Theatre. To see this ballet performed in this city, in this theatre, was mesmeric and a memory I will treasure forever. Spasiba, Petru. And so Ireland left for home with a silver medal in sailing and a bronze in boxing. As it transpired, I would be lucky enough to be involved in 4 more Olympic Games, Los Angeles, Seoul, Atlanta and Barcelona. Each one a wonderful experience, but of all of them, it's Moscow for me, which glows brightest in the memory.
My heart lifted when I opened my Facebook page on a bright day in May. First up, a post from the Féilín na Bealtaine Festival in Dingle, County Kerry, to celebrate May Day and the coming of summer. There she was, back. A 10-foot-high puppet of Peg Sayre's stepping out on a fine day from Curran's, the shop she worked in as a girl, to lead her people in the Bealtaine parade. She towered over them, Peg Moore as she was known, and they walked and danced the streets of the town. She was back among them with music, lights and a bright blue sky, celebrated and rightly so. For years I have been fixated with Peg Sayre's and the unfairness of the attitude towards her that developed over the years thanks to the book PEG being on the Leaving Certificate curriculum for decades. The story of this Kerry woman's hard life on the Great Blasket Island at the turn of the 20th century was transcribed from her Oscailge late in her life and taught in schools from the early 1960s onwards. Among many English-speaking students, her name stood for everything that was old, backward and dull in their view of the past. She was dismissed as an irrelevant old woman. That's very PEG, was a way of slagging off the old-fashioned and uncool. Time has passed. Many of those students are now middle-aged, and PEG's image is slowly and steadily changing. When her name is mentioned now, people don't cringe as much as they used to at the memory of their struggles with the Irish language at school. There have been recent books from folklore scholars who loved her work, such as the late Professor Bo Almquist from Sweden and his colleague and friend Pádraig O'Haly, who edited transcriptions of stories recorded when she was in her late 70s and ill in hospital in Dublin, her first time to visit the city. At this stage, PEG was almost blind, but she was lively and effervescent, still enjoying telling some of the stories she used to tell in the past to her friends. The book also contains CD recordings of PEG's strong voice recounting the tales. She was a born performer, and the fireside, and in this case the hospital bed, was her stage. The book is called Níl Deire Ráite, not the last word. And indeed, it's not. Last year, a beautiful exhibition was created at Molly, the Museum of Literature of Ireland, at Newman House on Stephen's Green, called Into the Island, with sounds and images from the Great Blasket Island where PEG lived for 40 years of her life, giving a sense of the imaginative lives of its inhabitants and their remarkable oral culture. Living on a rock, surrounded by wild seas, survival is tough. But when a community values story and music, as was the case on the Blasket, some of the richest literature in the Irish language emerged. PEG herself wasn't a writer. She never learned to write in her native language. She was a storyteller. She didn't invent stories, she retold them. Stories she'd heard all her life from her father, Tomás Sayers, and from other storytellers, and from her husband, Pádraig O'Guihín, known as Patsy Flint. He was a fisherman who brought stories home from the people of Ivrahach, who used to fish around the Blasket Islands. The stories PEG told include international folk tales, wonder tales, fairy tales, legends, and some very dark and savage ghost stories. Some of these have been loosely translated into English by the writer Éilis na Gaoine, and I've shared them with audiences on Orkney, in Hungary, in Scotland, and of course at home here in Ireland, sometimes accompanied by live animation created by the artist Rita Duffy. Recently, in the shadow of the Round Tower in Clondalkin, which was once a Viking stronghold, where Olaf, the first Viking king of Dublin, built his fort, I told one of PEG's stories, which begins, "A few hundred years after the Vikings left Ireland, there was a man who lived in the parish of Lispole in County Kerry." And on she goes, with a humorous story about a poor man who goes to Lochlann, the land of the Vikings, to seek back his fortune. The stories have provoked various reactions. In Kilkenny in March, we told some stories with music from the islands to a very knowledgeable audience of active retired people who are part of the Liberal Studies group. I told them PEG would be most impressed that such an erudite audience would listen so attentively to her stories. This provoked reminiscence of time spent in the Gaeltacht in West Kerry and stories of PEG herself. One woman told us how she had stayed in the house of Nurse Fitzgerald, who had nursed Peg in a hospital in Dingle, where she spent the last days of her long life. She had many visitors in hospital, whom she welcomed no matter how tired she was. One day, the nurse walked into the room. Peg's eyes were closed, but she was muttering away to herself. "I will do a kind lat feiniga, Peg," she asked. "Are you talking to yourself?" "Neil me," said Peg. "Tá me ag soliloquise oil." She was a bright and astute woman. She was well aware of the value of the hundreds of hours of recordings which were made of her voice and her stories by folklore collectors from all over the world, which would ensure she would not be forgotten. "For 55 years I gave my tongue no rest," she said, "and I'll still be talking long after I'm dead."
My mother used to always remind me that when I was an infant, gurgling happily on my blanket on the living room floor, if Elvis came on the television, I'd go crazy. She said I'd hear him singing and immediately start jigging. Then I'd see him across the room on the screen and I'd go into a sort of paroxysm, kicking and screaming and smiling in turns, fists in the air, my tiny body reverberating to his sound. So I suppose you could say I became a fan early. I had a tremendous bond with a woman called Elizabeth who used to babysit us. That bond was Elvis. We'd pore over magazine images of him, dance when he came on the radio, knock our knees and do the funny lip quiver. And on rainy Saturday afternoons, we'd snuggle on the couch and watch whatever Elvis film was on. One day I was down the town with Elizabeth and we called into her mam's house. The room was in semi-darkness and Elizabeth's mam embraced her muttering something in her ear. Elizabeth seemed to fall apart. She prized herself free from her mother's grip, howling, and raced to the bathroom, bolting the door. I stood in the kitchen in my knee socks and summer shorts, not knowing what to do. Her mam told me the king was dead. I knew who she meant instantly, and it wasn't long before Elizabeth reappeared and we all three wailed like banshees. So the years passed, and while the king had died, he lived on as a powerful cultural force. After all, who were the teenage boys of my generation channeling, if not Elvis, with their upturned collars that recalled Presley's and the hair so badly dyed that the jet black colour ran down the back of their necks on rainy days, staining their white T-shirts. It became fashionable to poo-poo Elvis. Ah, he was just a gorgeous singer all the women loved, who'd appropriated other people's music and hit the big time. Sure, with the corny movies, the underage marriage and the excess of Graceland, didn't he eventually become a parody of himself, I've heard it said. But I often challenge these naysayers and ask, can you name any other rock star, singer or performer who has ever rivaled Elvis? In terms of charisma, in terms of beauty, and live on stage, have you ever seen anyone else give of themselves so freely and completely? He simply sizzled, didn't he? If you need reminding, take a look at him in his black leathers in the 68 comeback special. In my own life, Elvis has been a recurring presence. He was a few years dead when on my birthday, my mother marched me into the local record shop and let me choose whatever album I wanted. I plumped for a double LP of Elvis, the cover depicting him in his lamb chop toting, glitter suit wearing glory. When I got it home, I played it until it hopped all over the turntable. When I worked at the Irish Repertory Theatre in New York, one of my co-actors, Rosemary Fine, played Mandy alongside my Bridget in the American premiere of the Magdalen Laundry play Eclipsed. Poor Mandy was obsessed with Elvis. I can still hear It's Now or Never blaring at full volume, and I can see Rosemary's black eyes burning as she lip-synced her way across the stage. And once I got to spend my own birthday in a way with the King. In a coincidence I can still barely believe, I learned at short notice that Elvis's original backing band would be performing in what's now the Three Arena, playing accompaniment to a gigantic hologram of him performing at the height of his powers. I organised a posse of friends and off we went. What a night! Thousands of people like myself revelling in the closest thing we'd ever gotten to experiencing a live Elvis show. It made me realise that as a performer, he gave his all. He seemed to have no filter, no boundaries. He gave everything of himself to his audience. That integrity he brought to his creativity in live performance, I think, along with demanding studios and managers, may have eventually led to his downfall. Perhaps it was just this vulnerability that was seized by opportunists out to make a profit no matter what. We've seen this time and time again with talented people, thinkers, designers, athletes, true artists everywhere, who deserve to be protected and nurtured, prized and encouraged to flourish so they can enlighten and inspire others. All of us, not just performers, have so much we can learn from Elvis. How can we give of our best, give 100%, without getting swallowed up by the machine?
Watching world-class Irish Olympians competing over the past 2 weeks in Paris, I cast my mind back to the games held there 100 years ago in 1924. That was the first year that Ireland participated as an independent nation, and my father, W.J. Boy Murphy as he was known, was a member of the boxing team. He was in the Irish National Army at the time. He was given the opportunity to turn professional, but on his father's advice, he decided to stay an amateur, a decision he never regretted. Instead, he joined an Garda Síochána in 1926 and went on to compete in the Amsterdam Olympics of 1928. He boxed successfully on international tours and won many national titles at middle and cruiserweights. I was an only child, born when my father was 52 years old. He passed away when I was 23. He was always a very gentle, soft-spoken man, and it was hard to imagine that he had ever slugged it out in the ring. It was only when the Olympics were first televised by RTE in the 60s that I heard him speak about his memories of 1924 and 1928. He was a big fan of Muhammad Ali, or Cassius Clay as he was known then. When his fights were broadcast, there was a brilliant buzz and it prompted great chats about boxing. As he watched Ali, His shoulders would twitch and sway as he added to every punch thrown and share the hurt of those received. One thing that sticks in my mind was my father's mantra: the more the opponent hurts you, the less you show it. He believed this psychology often got him out of sticky situations and allowed him to win in the end. In my teens, I hadn't much time for hearing about things that happened long ago. Instead, I wanted to be left alone to enjoy the music of the Beatles or the Bee Gees. Occasionally, concerts were broadcast from the Albert Hall. My father had often boxed there. Looking at the venue, he would begin quietly, "If I had a penny for every time I boxed there." Having heard this before, I would cheekily join in by the time he got to penny, as if to say, "I know, I know." He collected loads of newspaper articles and photos during his career and carefully kept them in a special box. He seemed to know that a time would come when they would become very important to me. I can hear his voice: "Maura, they'll be there for you when I'm gone." How right he was. As the years went by after his death, I began to appreciate the significance of his contribution to sport. Now that box would be the first thing to be grabbed in the event of a fire. I can think of so many questions I should have asked him about that time. I like to watch the film Chariots of Fire, which is set in the 1924 Games, just to absorb the atmosphere, to see the elegantly dressed ladies, all with beautiful hats, to feel what the world was like back in those days. On breaks between enjoying this year's games, I open my box of treasures to go back in time and read the old newsprint. It's fading, yellowed and fragile, and I try to smooth out the creases and protect the frayed edges. The photographs have held up well. I gaze at my father as a youngster of 20, training with his teammates at the Phoenix Park in preparation for their historic venture. Their coach, a Scottish man named Tansy Lee, smiles and seems pleased with his charges. He was a former British champion and was quoted as saying he would teach men to fight without bullets. The welterweight, Patrick Dwyer, was the most successful member of the team. He had 3 wins and was beaten in the semi-finals. My father was the next. He got a bye in the first round, beat a Polish man named Novak by a technical knockout, and then lost on points at the quarter-final stage to a Canadian by the name of Black. Newspaper articles suggest that there was discontent with the judges' decisions in both their final fights. Now, where have we heard that before? No boxing medals were won, but certainly the path was laid for what has become our most successful Olympic sport. My father would have been thrilled to see the success we've had in this year's games. None more so than that of the great boxer, Kelly Harrington, who won her 2nd gold medal on Tuesday evening. He would have been impressed too by the golds won in swimming, rowing, gymnastics, and the bronze medals also captured. How I would love to chat to him about it all. If I had a chance now to hear more about his experience, I would hang on every word. I'm so proud that my father was part of the team that held the tricolour aloft when Ireland took its place among the nations for the very first time.
They first glimpsed each other across the prayer beds at Loch Derg as they processed barefoot on stony ground, reciting aloud their rosaries. 2 youngish people, firm in their faith, following in the footsteps of countless pilgrims who've been visiting that sacred place in County Donegal since the 5th century. The year was 1950. They travelled separately to undertake the 3-day pilgrimage on Station Island, also known as St. Patrick's Purgatory. In fact, Dada had cycled the 100 miles from Castlebar in County Mayo before surrendering his shoes and socks and starting the strict regime of fasting, praying, and going without sleep for 24 hours. In between the incantation of rosaries and attendance at the vigil mass, there must have been time for the pilgrims to converse and socialise. As Michael Egan and Ethna Moran chatted to each other, they recognised that they were kindred spirits, hardworking, ambitious, and deeply faithful. For the times that were in it, both were relatively old to be still single. At 33, Dada had started his own solicitor's practice and was making progress. Mama was 26 and running a general store, pub, and animal feeds business, along with her long widowed mother, in the small village of Rathowen in County Westmeath. Clearly there was some spark between them during those three long days of prayer and spiritual introspection, for they agreed that upon leaving Loch Derg, they would meet up for a proper meal in the hotel in Roscommon. What they didn't realise was that there were two hotels in Roscommon, so each was deeply disappointed when the other didn't show up, both feeling that they'd been led a merry dance. Several months later in the lounge bar at Rathowen, while serving tea and sandwiches to members of a civil service interviewing panel travelling back from Castlebar, Ethna heard Dada's name being discussed. Her ears pricked up when she realised that he was one of the candidates the lunch party had just interviewed. Later, she contacted Dada with the intelligence she'd gleaned. Her serendipitous earwigging led them to finally meeting up, and so it was that their courtship commenced. Both being busy with their respective jobs, they settled on meeting for a few hours once a week in French Park, which was equidistant from Castlebar and Rathowen. Within a year, Dada had proposed and Mama was ready to accept. But when he completely forgot to mark her 27th birthday, she was deeply hurt. "How can I possibly marry such a thoughtless man?" she wondered to herself. And so she ordained a return visit to Loch Derg with Dada, with the express intention of seeking divine inspiration on the life-changing decision she had to make. On the final morning of their second pilgrimage to Loch Derg, Ethna was getting out of bed when she stubbed her foot on a sharp object on the floor of the women's dormitory. On inspection, she realised that she had stepped onto a large white button in the shape of a rose. This was the sign from above that Mama had been waiting for. As a symbol forever associated with the Virgin Mary, she took that rose-shaped cardigan button as a message directly from on high that she should accept Dada's hand in marriage. To be sure that she didn't falter at any more fences, Dada drove Mama directly from Loch Derg to Dublin to select her engagement ring, which he paid for with money he'd brought along from the recent sale of a horse. Before the turn of the year, they were married, after which a small wedding breakfast was hosted in the Prince of Wales Hotel in Athlone. But despite being newlywed, and rather unusually, their long-distance love story continued, as Granny deemed that Mama's full attention and personal presence was essential to the smooth running of her family business, Moran's Stores. So for the first 5 years of their marriage, they continued to live parallel lives, Dada working in Castlebar, while Mama remained in Rathowen, meeting up only at weekends. Following the birth of a fourth child in County Westmeath, they agreed that such a long-distance relationship was no longer tenable for their young and growing family. Mama finally moved to Castlebar. Granny Moran never fully forgave Dada for stealing Mama, the linchpin of her small business, away to the wilds of County Mayo. A further five children came along in short order, making that nine pregnancies in 11 years. as a parent of three grown adults, I remain in awe of what an extraordinary woman my mother was. And I often reflect that none of us nine children might ever have been born had Ethna not stubbed her foot on that spiky, rose-shaped button on the dormitory floor of St. Patrick's Purgatory at Lough Derg.
On this morning's programme, we heard Memories of Moscow, 1980, by John Kerwin. Peg Sayers, the Queen of Irish Storytellers, was by Nuala Hayes. Elvis and Me, by Amy Redmond. Paris Olympics, Then and Now, was by Maura O'Sullivan. And A Lough Derg Love Story, by John Egan. The music was Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, Prelude, played by the Bolshoi Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Georgi Jemchuchin. Port Nabucki, by Moira Nicolaeve. And that was preceded by an extract from a 1947 Radio Éireann recording of Peg Sayers telling a story. That can be found in the book L'Arhad Le Cóch by Peg Sayers, I Will Speak to You All, published by New Island Books. After that was If I Can Dream by Elvis Presley, live from the 1968 comeback special. And finally, Whalen Blues by the Cellar Boys. And a live miscellany event you may be interested in next month. To mark Culture Night at Áras an Uachtaráin, President Higgins and Sabina Higgins will host a recording of Sunday Miscellany. Because of the President's schedule with state business, this event will take place in advance of the official date of Culture Night. It will be on instead on Friday the 13th of September. This is a ticket-only event. To apply for tickets, please email your name, postal address and telephone number to culturenight@president.ie. culturenight@president.ie. Tickets will be awarded by lottery and the closing date for receipt of applications is this coming Friday. That's the 16th of August 2024. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can find out more about Sunday Miscellany on the programme website. And you can also listen back on the RTE radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.